event started a long time ago in numerous conversations that Myra Maimon and I had as Radcliffe was establishing a public policy institute, and I was trying to infuse into all of the institution a sense of commitment for a societal orientation and a greater attention being paid to public policy and the things we were doing that could contribute to that. Myra is one of the most responsive people in an academic setting you could ever want, and she immediately lined up and saying, all right, what are we going to do about the arts and public policy? We are now celebrating the 5th anniversary of the Policy Institute, and we're just now really getting together around the connection between arts and public policy that has been a dream and a vision for Myra for all this long time. It's not been an easy conversation getting here because we wanted it to be deep. We wanted it to connect people from many different sectors. We wanted to help move the conversation about the role and significance of arts in our society along. And this is the beginning of what we hope will be an annual dialogue, an annual forum called the Radcliffe Arts Policy Forum. We hope it will continue for many, many years to come. This afternoon is really a kind of triple or even quadruple header. It is the first of these conversations. It's also, as I said, the 5th anniversary of our Public Policy Institute, and this is a wonderful way to help celebrate that. But even more important, it is the 25th anniversary of the Office of the Arts for Harvard and Radcliffe. At the same time, it is a very special time in our local community, as it is the launch of the first Boston Cyber Arts Festival, and this policy forum is part of that. Adding to my pleasure at this evening, this is really quite an extraordinary day for us, is the fact that the individual who will come and welcome you again and introduce our panelists and then participate is Marion Godfrey, a Radcliffe alumna, who is the director of the culture program of the Pew Charitable Trusts in Philadelphia. I'm very pleased that it is a Radcliffe graduate who is spearheading one of the first national efforts to add a new direction to the conversation about arts policy. So again, let me say welcome to this event and celebrate with us all these firsts, fifths, and 25ths, and enjoy this afternoon. Let me welcome our moderator, Marion Godfrey.
Good afternoon. I'm really thrilled to be here. It's always wonderful to come back to Cambridge in the middle of May when Harvard is looking its most resplendent and the grass is greenest and we're not allowed to walk on it. It's really wonderful. This is really looking forward to a terrific panel. Let me just tell you, I'm not going to do the real introductions yet. Let me tell you how this afternoon will go, however. The first order of business, which I think is only appropriate in to introduce a discussion about the arts and arts policy, is that we are going to be given the pleasure of experiencing about 10-minute piece by Harvard graduate Sasha Costanza-Chock, who I'll introduce in a second. After that piece is completed, he will sit down at the table with the rest of the panelists. I will at that point introduce the other panelists and give you a little bit of an introduction of the conversation itself, and then we will launch in. We will talk among ourselves for a while on a couple of questions that Myra has posed for us, and then we will open it up to have a broader conversation with all of you. So let me introduce Sasha Costanza-Chock. He's class of 98. He makes electronic and acoustic music, short animated films, video installations, giant puppets and poems separately and in various combinations. So right off the bat, you see that this kind of hybrid quality of the work that we're going to see is one of the great characteristics of, I think, all the work we'll be talking about today. He studied electronic music and cultural studies at Harvard University and works with a Boston-based Toneburst collective, throwing inexpensive, no-holds-barred experimental multimedia events in alternative venues around the East Coast. Some of his work can be found at www.toneverse.com, and some more can be found at www.theory.com. Most recently, he produced a two-day music festival for the Cyber Arts Festival, which is just winding up today, I understand. So let me introduce to you Sasha Chalk. Thank you.
Hello. I'm going to give you a short excerpt from a much longer installation and performance work that I finished at the end of last year. The piece is called Infrasound, and it's about the development of sound technologies as actual instruments of destruction. So there's a long historical trajectory which has led up to recent development of sound cannons that can actually destroy organic tissue and resonate buildings to pieces and so on. The piece is not only about that, it's also about the parallel development of people using sound technologies in ways resistant to the structures that are developing these weapons. So people create, mobile sound systems and boom boxes and jeep beats and take over urban space with sound. Sound is used as a sort of cultural weapon as well as an actual physically destructive weapon or means of social control. And so in its original form, a lot of the material that you'll be seeing is actually set up through a resonant chamber where the footage is being manipulated and distorted by the sound that's actually being produced in the space. And I didn't have time or resources to set that up here today, but this is just a brief excerpt from the Infrasound installation. To begin with, I assembled a timeline in an attempt to sketch that historical development of sound technology. In 1827, the microphone was developed. In 1858, the phonograph, and in 1929, magnetic sound recording on plastic tape. And within this timeline, another begins to emerge. In 1938, Hitler used a massive PA system to address crowds. In 1941, Nazi forces advancing into Russia used portable speaker systems to amplify demands for surrender, and Nazi scientists engineered V-1 rockets or buzz bombs to emit terrifying whines as they fell over the city of London. In 1947, the sound barrier was broken, and soon after that, the U.S. Air Force set up a mock town in the desert in order to test the structural damage caused by sonic booms. And volunteers from nearby towns were asked to come and sit and with clipboards and sort of take notes as these planes flew in at different altitudes and different speeds, and take notes as to how much the various booms hurt. And sensors were placed on structures to see, how much they could stand. And in 1962, the U.S. military put that research to work, to use. And during the Cuban Missile Crisis, U.S. jets actually made terror dives over the city of Santiago de Cuba. And they came in at high speeds and pulled out close over the city and shattered windows throughout the city. So let's begin the video. It says, U.S. naval jets based at Guantanamo Bay Naval Station made terror dives over the city of Santiago de Cuba, some 120 miles from their base. The sound waves produced when the jets pulled out of their dives shattered windows in schools, apartment houses, and hospitals of the city. trenches of war. I'm writing this from beneath the ground, from the sub-basement, from the iron piling, from the pillars that support the Empire State Building. Writing as we approach the citadel of the center, our army surplus truck loaded with homemade speaker columns, subwoofers, and directional sound weapons. We have prepared attack, sudden transformation of subwoofers into a hammer against the viscera, resonating in the large intestines, the dirt of crumpled and broken loose. They are busy erecting walls. We pass through them like light through transparency, our earthquake tones bursting and rolling through all barricades, borders, and boundaries. From the National Archives in Washington, D.C., I gathered footage of U.S. troops in Korea and Vietnam setting up loudspeaker systems outside villages that they are about to attack, bombarding them with the sounds of grenades exploding or trucks and tanks approaching. Shots of them unscrewing tank cannons and replacing them with tweeters, mounting racks of speakers on helicopters, jeeps, and tanks, carrying them through the jungle on their backs. They were the Psych Ops Warfare Team, Psychological Operations Warfare, an experiment in the use of sound to create terror and destroy enemy morale. They set up these speakers and broadcast the sounds of exploding bombs just before they attacked with conventional weapons. Imagine what it would be like to have these sounds come at you if you'd never heard a speaker system before. An alien invasion. Sound as a weapon was nothing new. The U.S. military got the idea from Hitler, who did the same thing during World War II. From the archives, I also pulled captured German footage of Nazis setting up loudspeakers during an attack on Russia in the winter. Tape spinning, cold, microphones against steaming breath. Nothing new. The captured German footage revealed the extended arm of Nazi experimentation with the effect of amplification technology on the human psyche. Hitler was the first to address large crowds through a massive PA system. No wonder, his voice, amplified a thousandfold, must have seemed like the voice of God to those assembled. The power of volume, the physical intoxication of sound battering the body for the first time. Sound rubbing the belly, expanding in the spine. Arm hairs rising in vibrant air. Another timeline began to emerge. A history of ever more powerful sound weapons created and deployed for purposes of war or for riot control, the effective containment of urban unrest. In 1973, the sound purger system was deployed by British forces against Irish independence activists. The purger uses high volume, high frequency tones to induce nausea, pain, and panic. In 1989, the CIA agents in Panama used NASA loudspeaker systems to blast heavy metal in an attempt to disorient and capture General Manuel Noriega. And by 1992, the U.S. government developed infrasonic weapons, fully directional sound cannons that use frequencies below audible range and are capable of causing nausea, disorientation, and high-intensity death. By now, in 1999, These absurdly advanced technologies of destruction have come near the full circle, returning us to the shuttered walls of biblical Jericho, bringing us to the point of mythological power. Now in 1999, Mayor of New York City Rudolph Giuliani has planned to place a system of decibel sensors on every street corner in Manhattan's Lower East Side. The sensors will relay the sounds of block parties, political rallies, and approaching uprisings back to the bunker it has been holed up in for 3 months, the bunker that used to be called City Hall. But we won't be able to do this without resistance. Just like cameras installed in New York subway stations soon had their surveillance eyes breaking to shut by graffiti kids, audio anarchists will build small noise generators and position them near the decibel sensors, overloading the computers with a barrage of high levels, drawing attention away from the necessary sounds of light and interruption.
That's a great way to start off this panel. Thank you very much. Let me introduce the rest of the panelists and then make some comments to start off this conversation. To my immediate right is, I've already forgotten how to say your name, Thomas Hoag, right? Who is the founder and managing director of the Arts Alliance, which is a venture capital fund which supports many companies of artists doing new work, and he will be talking about that in detail. He has a background as a creative artist himself, but he works as a venture capitalist. Mm-hmm. Thomas founded Arts Alliance in 1997 with the intention of combining his artistic and business background to form a new type of venture capital company and online catalyst, which helps develop internet and new media startups, which taps into a network of experts and which acts as a research lab as well as an informed source of investment. He has in-depth knowledge of new media and the internet, including time spent as content manager for Firefly Network, Inc. In his role as an independent artistic director, he has led a variety of projects, including the opening and closing ceremonies for the 1994 Winter Olympics, the 50th anniversary of the ending of World War II, and the Ibsen Stage Festival in Norway. He received an MBA from Harvard Business School and a BFA in theater from the Northwestern University. He also spent 2 years in the Royal Norwegian Navy with 1 year aboard a missile torpedo boat, which is not, maybe not as off the subject as I thought it was now that we've seen Sasha's piece. Yeah. To his right is Sandra Brayman, who is the Reese Pfeiffer Professor of the Department of Telecommunications and Film at the College of Communication and Information Sciences at the University of Alabama. Sandra Berman has been doing research on the macro level effects of the use of new information technologies and their policy implications since the early 1980s. She has published more than 36 scholarly journal articles, edited several books and journal issues, served as book review editor of the Journal of Communication, and served as consultant for numerous private and public organizations. She is also a writer and performance artist. Her scholarly and artistic interests have come together in a stream of publications, lectures, and workshops in the area of electronic art. This work includes attention to changes in the role of the artist and arts today, art in the global information economy, emergent policy issues for artists in the electronic environment, and the use of electronic art for the purposes of community development. Jonathan Citrain is the executive director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, lecturer on law at the Harvard Law School. He teaches cyber law at Harvard Law School while directing all of the Berkman Center's activities. He has worked overseas with the U.S. Department of State on crisis management and for the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Citrain, Jonathan holds a JD from Harvard Law School, magna cum laude, an MPA from the JFK School of Government, and a BS in Cognitive Science and Artificial Intelligence from Yale. He is also a 14-year veteran SysOp of CompuServe's online forums and currently serves as chief SysOp of its SysOp forum. And let me just say one additional word about myself. I have no credentials in cyber arts, but I am, before coming to the Pew Charitable Trust in 1989, I did work as a manager, producer, and fundraiser in the nonprofit performing arts. And with a bit of experience in more traditional media, I produced a film for Nabu Lions, which is a company that I worked for a long time. We have a challenge today. We have now considerably less than 2 hours to discuss a number of questions of real complexity related to the subject of our forum, whose title is Art and Technology, Policy Pitfalls and Parameters. We are being recorded live and broadcast live on the web by WHRB. And so we were talking earlier today about, we were wondering who owns the rights to that material today, who's the intellectual property owner of our conversation, but we'll leave that to be moot. Our topic relates, first of all, to cyber art, which has been defined in many ways, but one definition that I thought I'd cite is any artistic endeavor in which computer technology is used to expand the artistic possibilities. That is, where the computer and its associated software are an element in the creative process in the same way that paint, photographic film, musical instruments, and other materials have always been used to express an artist's vision. And I have no doubt that as our conversation goes on, we will hear a much more sophisticated set of definitions of cyber art from our panelists. I think what's particular and perhaps different about the cyber art that will probably be the primary focus of our conversation today is that it blurs the lines between the creator and the user. Oftentimes it deals with issues of appropriation, so that there are a lot of intellectual property concerns that are raised by it, and there are also a lot of other concerns that are raised in terms of who makes it, who uses it. I'd also like to just take a minute to talk about what do we mean by policy, because I've learned in recent months that policy is kind of a Lewis Carroll suitcase word. It can sort of mean anything you want it to, but it also can be an obfuscating word. I think for the uses of this conversation, we can say that among the policy concerns that are related to cyber arts are a series of concerns having to do with issues of control. Who makes the art? Who uses it? Where does the creative act take place between the creator and the user? Who owns it? Who benefits from it, who benefits from it economically, who benefits from it in terms of its being a social good. I think some of the policy questions we will get into are impacts of government regulations or legislation, whether it's purposely or inadvertently affecting the creation of cyber art or public access to it. Certainly policy questions related to the online environment include the fairness and effectiveness of existing copyright laws, but also questions about access to and control of the Internet itself. And there are also questions about freedom of expression that are all wrapped up in this. There are business policies, such as the entertainment industry's increasing practice of contracting artists for hire rather than licensing and paying fees and royalties for work made by artists. There are government and foundation funding policies regarding subsidy of cyber artists or cyber artworks that might also be considered in a policy discussion. We want to try to focus this conversation rather than having a completely wide open discussion. We'd like to focus this conversation on three specific subjects related to cyber arts and the policy pitfalls and parameters of this new field. One, art can now be widely disseminated on the web, where it is usually accessible for free and sometimes available for interactive reshaping and recombination. Our traditional ideas about intellectual property rights are challenged by both the architecture and the values of the web, and I would also say not just the web, but as my panelists have reminded me, by other interactive forms of art making using computer technology. What must change in our thinking and in our law concerning intellectual property, and where are we now in the process of change? What reforms are necessary? Who is driving the decision-making about reform, and what is the time frame? Second, what kinds of relationships are being forged between artists and corporations working with new technologies? What opportunities and what challenges do these relationships present to artists? And third, cyber artists are now working in many computer-based forms in the United States. What are the structures for supporting their work? The U.S. has developed the technologies, but it lags behind Europe in supporting the artists to work with them. What should be done to support and bring forth the talents and ideas of cyber artists? And in that, I'm hoping that we will touch on a number of questions, including the fact that we have a very limited discourse on this subject so far, both from art historical and from journalistic points of view, although I think there's probably a significant body of discussion among cultural theorists. And another aspect in relation to that, which I think we will hear about, is the difficulty of creating a traditional market for this work, but particularly we'll hear from Thomas about new ways of thinking about the economic structures that can involve this work. We would like, although copyright issues are of great importance to this discussion, we want them not to monopolize all of our attention today, so part of my task will be to encourage the panelists to spend some time dealing with intellectual property and copyright issues, and then to pass on to other questions that I've raised, and then in the process we will also open it up to you. So I've asked Sasha if he'd be willing to be first on the hot seat here and talk a little bit about the work that he has just generously shown us, and talk about policy issues that he has confronted in the making and the showing of that work. Sasha.
You just said that you wanted to steer it clear from the copyright discussions. I think it's probably
No, I just don't want the whole 2 hours on it, that's all. We got to start there, I'm sure, yeah.
I think we should start there. It's the first thing that jumps to my mind. As an electronic musician, a lot of my work is music, and a lot of it is sampler-based music, collage, sound, and although that's not something that's new with computers, that's been done, you know, with tape certainly, and I would argue has always been done. It's just that now that process is externalized into, you know, this machine that people are using, as opposed to people sort of lifting melodies and things as they always have. You know, certainly there's a lot of debate right now in the media about, you know, sound, music and music copyright protection, especially with the advent of MP3 technology, which, you know, immediately sort of took fire. And if you would like to, you know, if you'd like to download your favorite piece of current pop music, all you have to do is go onto the net and type in the name of the artist and MP3, and more likely than not, you'll find several sites where people have posted that music there. And there's all kinds of people working on, you know, encryption and digital watermarks technologies that will allow people to track and control that kind of dissemination of music. But it's pretty clear to me at this point that no matter what encryption technologies are developed, there will be people hacking them. There will always be people trying to find ways around them, and they'll be successful, and it kind of, you know, it goes back and forth, it escalates. But in this piece that you saw here, I guess some of the slides which were being projected that talk about the history of the development of sound technology, some of that information was, I found much of it on the internet. In fact, there's a wonderful site called the Media History Project, and I'd say about 60% of the dates in those slides were taken from that project. Now, I mean, I don't really want to just go on. Maybe
well, let me just ask you one question, and then we'll bring in the rest of the panel. As an artist, are you more concerned about having access to things that you might want to use in your art, or are you more concerned about protecting your own artwork from other people doing the same thing?
Right. Yeah. Well, as an artist, at this point, I feel like the more that material that I work on and create is disseminated and ends up out there, the happier I am about it. And I'd have to say that as far as music and protection goes, one thing that I've been working on with some friends of mine, and we are really excited about, is the possibility of using, of considering music and now all forms of art really more like shareware than like products that you pay for. Mm-hmm. And we've had some success putting, you know, free music on our website, and people come and they can download either, you know, an entire song or a fragment of a song, or maybe you could say, here's a song you can have for free. If you like it, then send us a check and we'll send you an entire CD. And I think, you know, we've started to have some success with that. We've just put it up. And, you know, I think you're going to see that kind of thing more and more as artists are now able, artists in all media really, are able to just, you know, put their work out there and skip the industries that have traditionally been the distributors of music, of mm-hmm. film, of video anyway. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm.
This is a great lead-in to you, Thomas, to talk about how you operate in this environment.
Well, I would actually, I think I'm going to ask Sasha a question that retains to what we saw. You said that 60% of those dates were taken from a website that you found that was interesting, but we didn't see anything that you made an acknowledgement of that. So, if we didn't have that discussion now, we would have thought that that was your work. In many ways, it is your work because you put it together in this fashion. But if the 60% of the dates and the thinking in those terms were taken somewhere else, one could argue that it would be appropriate to give some sort of recognition to whoever you took it from, as it was not obvious because it's not recognizable in the sense of belonging to anyone. I'm wondering how you feel about that. If I had a performance tomorrow where I took 60% of your work and called it mine?
Well, I have two answers to that question. And the first is that in the full work, all my sources are credited. Mm-hmm. This being just a little excerpt that I threw together.
Okay.
So the sources are credited. But my second answer is that, to your second question, is that it would really depend to me on what you did with it. And if you did something with it that I thought really just kind of lifted everything from my work and didn't add much on your own, I wouldn't get upset and I wouldn't sue you, but I'd think that you made some terrible art because all you did was rip me off. But if you managed to reconfigure it and, you know, bring in new elements that really, you know, recontextualize the piece and add something new to it, I would be happy with the sort of recombinant spawn of my mental processes and yours.
Well, these are issues that are brought up in, and this is not a very clear cut, but there are especially issues in music that where those boundaries are very blurred, and especially when in the dance music culture, where new and very popular songs are created on the basis of very known melodies that people are known as hits from so for instance I could go into a club. I'm 32 years old. I would go into a club that kind of arranged for my age group, and they would maybe have lots of dance music that was sampled on ABBA, for instance, and I would recognize it. I would feel at home. It would be a completely new piece of music, and it would be sold and earn money on top of that. And those are some of the issues where it's very difficult to define who owns and who's the most important aspect of a piece of music. And that's very complex. When you then in turn provide that opportunity to download it again and reappropriate it in another layer. There was an experiment done, or not an experiment, but there was a trend about a year ago when the MP3 sort of craze started, where you would find music on a website. Today, about 90% is not on websites because the record labels are going after that. We've actually sent three email services. So we talked about before we started that the trend is that in a lot of colleges, one person goes out and buys a piece of music, and then they send it out to all their friends. And it's kind of a status symbol to buy that piece of music, because then you are the early adopter. You're viewed as among your peers as the one that as a trendsetter. However, it's not important enough then for other people to own the same commodity if they can then get it from a friend electronically. Those issues are almost impossible to evaluate where the boundaries lie of copying for a friend, which people have done for decades, and where it becomes an industry and becomes sort of a factor in the economics of how the music industry works. And I don't have a strong view on the policy issues of that, but I see from I work a lot with music companies, internet-based, sort of the next generation music companies, and they are now flirting with the idea where they say, well, the music itself is not necessarily where they're going to make the money by putting some sort of a price on the music. It is in what context you see the music. So they bring people into a space where then they would sell advertising for consumer products or something like that. And they pay the artist for the right to have that music in that space. And it's kind of like in some to what Sasha said about freeware. It's a freeware, but it is originated somewhere, and that is where the value is created. And these are very complex matters, and they haven't figured out how to do themselves. But we're going to see the music industry, probably the first industry with all these barriers being broken down, and it's going to send the trend for film and entertainment, and also for other art forms that are less sort of easy to transmit through electronic mediums.
Thanks. Sandra, maybe you could probe down to another level. I know you talk a lot about the various steps in the process of making an artwork and different rights questions associated with different steps of the process. Maybe you could lead us a little more down along that line.
Yeah, my feeling is that a lot of the problems we have trying to resolve these very complex intellectual property rights issues in the net environment derive from trying to think about property in the way in which it has operated in the economy for the last several hundred years. We have several different ways of thinking about what we mean by an information economy, but the view that I buy is that the nature of that economic processes are qualitatively different today, that the market itself has actually disappeared. Markets exist when there's space in between entities, and those spaces are now gone, just as we say there's no outside in the net environment. We are so multiply interlinked as entities, as various kinds of entities. What that means is that for the question of intellectual property rights in an artwork, is that the question of where the work is and what it is we want to stake property rights in has really changed, and there are four elements of that that I would try to draw our attention to. First is that I think in most cases now what we're looking at is staking out intellectual property rights in a process, not in a fixed product. For the world of economics as it has existed for several centuries, a commodity had to be fixed in time and space. You had to be able to say, there it is. We can't do that anymore. And in fact, one of the features of art in the net environment is that it has multiple manifestations. That leads some people to say it's always feminine, but I won't touch that. But that there are multiple manifestations, not just that it changes over time, but even what the thing is. There's a guy named Jeffrey Schultz in New York, the high performer, whose net art consists of rollerblading from ATM machine to ATM machine and engaging with the ATM machines. What you've got there, if you're a collector, is a map of his ATM path and some slips of what he's done with your card. Hopefully you had an agreement about what he was going to do with your card. But, you know, and you've got a piece of performance art on Wall Street as he's doing this and so on. So there are multiple different aspects of what you mean by the work. From the corporate side, clearly, more and more artists are being brought into the corporate world, and it's because it's become recognized that there's economic value in the innovative ideas, the ability to think of new goals even for the products that we generate. And that leads to the question of where it is that the value is added that we're trying to stake out the property rights in. If it's in the process of innovation itself, then you're not concerned about selling the work. You're concerned about where innovations go. There are some developments in intellectual property rights where they're beginning to stake out ways of where you're trying to gain ownership as early in processes as possible so that you own everything that comes from a process. This is very big in biotechnology, where you want not just the genetic transformations, but you want to be the owner of the way of transforming the genes, and then you own everything else that comes from that. I've been a little bit surprised that artists have not been more aggressive about staking out their rights to things that flow from their innovative ideas, because that's really where the larger value is going to come. Another way of thinking about it is that if value is added every time information is processed, then it is easier to think about assigning property rights to collaborative efforts and also to traditional and communal efforts. There has always been a difficulty in for traditional cultural practices staking out property rights, but if we acknowledge that the value comes from all the processing, and you look at a traditional culture where you've got tens of thousands of people over tens of thousands of years producing something, we can begin to see why those should be treated as valuable and where the property rights might be put. The other side of that also is the flip side of innovation is the cultural capital side. And down the road in this conversation, if we come back to economic issues, I'll be arguing that one of the things we're experiencing across the economy is a reconceptualization, a rearticulation of an information production chain. What is creation? What is storage? What is distribution? And that artists need to stake out for themselves a distinct phase in that information production chain. Among the unique things that artists bring to what they do is cultural capital, is a knowledge of the past and a constant attention to what the past means as it's brought into the present. That's an aspect of artistic process and product that we have not been thinking about when we think look at the economic value and where the property rights might go. The last comment I'd make right now about property is that as we talk about digital watermarks and so on, we can see that the nature of property itself becomes changed in the web environment in a sense it can become a tool of surveillance. As in order to know what people are doing and make sure that they're attending to whatever economic relationship you want them to attend to, that you're starting to track people. And at that point, the nature of property itself becomes a very different thing.
Great, thanks. Jonathan, I'm wondering if you could come at this from the point of view that I know you've been working on specifically with relation to the question of copyright term extension, but could you maybe talk about the loss of, or the shifting balance, loss of a good balance between the commons and ownership situation?
Sure.
In this situation.
First, I was intrigued after Sasha's presentation all about sound and its uses that we responded to it in the perfectly normal way that suddenly had so much meaning. We were all there going, you know, throwing sound at the wall to say how much we liked it, which I did very much. So, thank you. So I start at a starting point that says, what actually makes cyber art different from art with respect to all these policy issues? We've already heard a lot on that. The things I would identify are some of the things Sasha talked about just at the beginning. First is there's a lot more appropriation going on. I don't know how you measure it, what the units of appropriation in art are. An appropriation not as a valence term, a bad thing to happen, but a creative, an inspiration-like thing where you can draw so readily and costlessly from what has come before, be it pop cultural icons or, you know, you surf on a website, you find something you like, you grab it, and there it is, it's in your work, and you can put together something entirely new for which before you had the cyber part of things, it really would have entailed, you know, going through newspapers and clipping out things or Xeroxing. I mean, it was a very different way of going about it. A second thing that seems to make cyber art different is what I call the parties to the deal, that the people that consider themselves artists, producers of the content, it might be a much bigger class of people now. To be sure, anybody before there was cyber art could have, in the privacy of their own home, painted all they wanted or written all the essays they wanted. But the way now that one can do so with relatively high production values relative to the values that the so-called professional producers are doing, and can have it available to so many people so readily. Once you do it in your home and then put it on your website, it is as open to the world as anything else is, subject only to people finding it and giving attention to it. That's another distinct feature of cyber art. And the third, to appropriate a sentence or a phrase from a completely different context, is that the means of production is in the hands of the workers. And by that, I only mean that Sasha's able to, on a PC platform, use programs, be it Photoshop or PowerPoint or audio programs, to put together and generate sounds and distort them, able to generate the product. And again, these means of doing so, he doesn't, once he has the program, have to go to anybody for permission or for collaboration or anything else to do it. So that being the case, there's a reason why Sasha, who presents a perfectly consistent way of being an artist, he says, I'll take what I please, and in the meantime, take what you please from me. I won't respect you particularly if all you do is take it and put your name on it, but feel free to use it to inspire your own work. Of course, many artists don't have Sasha's view, and the artists and those who represent them in the respective publishing and recording industries see people like Sasha as a threat. I mean, Sasha and his siblings and his spawn are threats to an established order, both in the sense of, to the extent that you don't have a single industry that converges ultimately to Rupert Murdoch as the source of your entertainment or your artistic enjoyment, that is a threat to Rupert Murdoch, who would just as soon have you come to him for everything. And secondly, the idea of appropriation. We do have a norm that has taken root and hasn't fully taken root. Sasha does not share it, but many do, and it may be even a generational thing, a norm that says that which you create is yours. It's intellectual property, emphasis on the property part of it. And what that means is if you don't want to share it, you don't have to share it. And if somebody takes it from you when you didn't want them to, you can call out the government hounds and they'll go chase the person and punish them appropriately. And this norm says that threat that those who perceive it as such have given. First is changes in code. Why don't we just alter the way the technology works so that it's a lot harder, for instance, to appropriate stuff? Sasha says, go ahead, make my day. You can make all the changes you want to the code, but there will be hackers that will always get around it, and we have a pleasant arms race, and you know, it's Natasha and Boris chasing each other around, and eventually you know, we win. I'm somewhat skeptical of that, because particularly if you want to say who are the parties who might be able to consider themselves artists, I see no particular reason to have to circumscribe that group by artists who either are or know hackers. It may be that Sasha is either particularly talented or knows those who are, so that he can get around whatever blocks may be put in some of the systems that have been talked about so far, be it watermarking or streaming technologies that lock up the content. They just give you that one listen and you can't copy and paste it into your own work. I would actually be concerned at the evolution of that code and think that there is a policy reason not to just let the industry develop it one way or another. And of course, it's also been mentioned that the code can control and meter usage. Sandra talked about process as itself a source of new property. And of course, by that, you imagine, I don't know how many people remember Spirograph. I mean, the things you might generate with Spirograph. Could the Spirograph company say, well, guess what? You and I, Spirograph, generated them together. So, okay, partner, you know, this is how we're going to market our work. And you realize that the people who make Photoshop could say, you know, you did that nifty little blurring around the edges. That was thanks to our codec plugin, et cetera, et cetera. You know, guess what? We're now a co-author with you. And it's not the touchy-feely language of, great, we're all co-collaborationists. It's the language of, that's a derivative work produced by a process governed by intellectual property for which we claim ownership. And you see both the code possibly able to back that up. In fact, you could even see a reversion to the era where people would be desperate to log time in a good recording studio so that they're not at home with their 8-track deck and a microphone. They've got 30 minutes in the studio. They're planning out exactly, kind of like a shopping spree, how they're going to make the most of that half hour that costs so much. We've reverted now to, all right, everybody has Photoshop and the corresponding audio tools. Now everybody has it. You could actually imagine streaming those tools so that you don't have Photoshop. Mm-hmm. What you have is access to the Photoshop program for a particular period of time, however it is to be measured, and you pay as you go for that. Again, the world that emerges one way or the other has amazing implications for the arts, but at the moment it's just, well, you know, Photoshop will decide what's the most remunerative way for it to distribute its particular code. The other barrier, aside from code, that might be put up to stop people like Sasha from doing what they do would be a big squadron of lawyers. And right now, the copyright law is such that a big squadron of lawyers can cause a lot of headaches for Sasha. Now, Sasha may say, you know, go ahead, make my day, I'm judgment proof. And that is actually the best defense he may have to such somebody going after him actually for infringement. But the fact is, if you have any wealth at all, the prospect of a lawsuit, the threat alone, is enough to get you to change your behavior. If somebody came in today, hi, I represent the people that actually took that picture, guess what, I'm getting an injunction that says you can't show your work anymore, Sasha would be then in contempt of court if he ignored it. So those are the things that may come up to block this particular way of expressing cyber art and having it reach what you might describe as its full potential, given the power of the net to allow so many people who couldn't afford to become artists. And then it might be worth it to say, all right, well, what are the responses to the responses? What could we do as a policy matter to address it? But instead of going to that, why don't I turn it back over to you?
Well, I'd actually like to follow that up with addressing a question to all of you. You've just given a description, which I think is kind of scary, of the potential of the corporate interest to really kind of take over and use copyright law as a bludgeon to their own benefit. But turning around and looking at the other aspect of why copyright law was originally written into our Constitution, which was that it was supposed to create an incentive for people to be creative and to produce innovations. And yet, one of the things I think I've heard in some ways from all of you is that artists right now don't seem to need that incentive right now. Is this an obsolete idea? Is this aspect of the copyright law, in fact, getting to be obsolete in terms of how people think about creative and innovative activity?
Well, for a moment, maybe, why don't I represent the recording industry or
okay. Somebody
like that, the people I was just bashing. And you'd say, all right, fine, maybe there are new ways of capturing value. Maybe there's a new group of people that want to do it in their spare time, so they don't care about getting paid. Or maybe they think they're going to get paid in the shareware mode, where they'll give it away and then it will come on the back end as people appreciate it and want to see more and then give money afterwards. That may well be, they would say, but that should be then the choice. Sasha is free to produce stuff and give it away if he wants, but why take away our protection for our stuff if we choose to avail ourselves of it? And to that, I would say it's a kind of multilateral disarmament that you need. You actually need everybody to step a few steps backward from the current regime and have the help of law so that it's all done equally, not just Sasha does it and Prince does it and Madonna doesn't. Not to put you in with those people. You're much better than they are. Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, indeed, it was actually intellectual property that got Prince to rename himself. He felt like even his name was owned by the recording label, so he got rid of the name. So anyway, it suggests that to the extent that the framers had in mind a balance, you get an exclusive monopoly on your work that lets you sell it and then get money back, and after which it goes into the public domain, so people like Sasha or anybody else can take it and use it. That started out at 12 years. You know, all right, you have 12 years, that's your big shot, and after that, it's open. And it's incrementally, particularly in the past 50 years, gone up. Now we are at, thanks to the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, we are at 95 years of copyright protection, and that's done retroactively. And of course, the thing we peg it to is it's almost a cyber thing. It's a multimedia thing. It's that Steamboat Willie, the very first Disney cartoon featuring what doesn't exactly look like him, but it's Mickey Mouse dancing around on the deck of a boat, that is just about to enter the public domain. And every time it's about to happen, Congress passes retroactive copyright term extension, and Mickey Mouse is safe for another 20 years. And that really is
funny. We're safe from Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're still inundated with him. It's just we can't take him and do something to him.
Sure isn't theorists out there that love that connection.
Yeah.
The interesting thing here is about sort of the civil disobedience aspect of what Sasha is doing. It's the fact that he's not alone. It's so massive in this country and on the internet that you have, it's actually becoming interesting, seen from the intellectual property owners as a sense of marketing. They see that the copying of the Disney cartoons or the Warner Brothers cartoons that we all know is so extensive that it's viewed as a way of disseminating these characters in the form of marketing. So for instance, on a GeoCities or Tripod set of home pages, which is basically a space where people can go and build their own web pages, it is so extensive that they are shifting their thinking about it from being, well, we have to get rid of that, where they kind of have admitted that that's not going to happen anyway, to say, well, maybe it's actually working in our favor. And the question we talked about a little before downstairs, before this preparation, was the fact that there seems to be some sort of a level when a property is so well known that for us that don't need an introduction to it. But so when we see it in conjunction with something else, we can immediately identify who created it and therefore give value to that creator. And in many ways, the assembler adds more value to the originator of the original piece in the context, because it doesn't really matter, because we know the value of that original piece has its value, regardless if it's butchered and put together in a horrible way, because that will, again, we will have a comment as observer of that art or you know, creation. We will say, well, we didn't like the way they treated Mickey Mouse, because we know what Mickey Mouse is. And we have a relationship with Mickey Mouse. And it's a really interesting balance. So where does it become famous enough or well-known enough that we can see through the use that we actually see in front of us?
So that it functions as a homage or as a citation, in effect, and has that kind of power. I'd like to... go ahead.
I would come at the question you asked from another direction, which is that intellectual property rights as embedded in the Constitution are a real expression of modern thought. We are, for lots of reasons, describing today's era as a postmodern era. And you had the notion then of a state that was capable of exercising its control over a population that was geographically defined, no longer the case in this environment. You had the notion of an individual as separate from other individuals and whose work would be all of her own or all of his own, and the notion of creation of an object sort of like laying an egg as a singular act. And I think each of those has become unbundled. We're beginning to understand that the ability of an entity to enforce or any kind of social structure to enforce its rules depends not so much on the definition of a nation state, but on other ways of influencing what happens. We are certainly acknowledging that individuals do not act alone. We are always resting upon those who have come before and those with whom we work, and we are unbundling the creative process into these different elements of bringing the past, the creative moment, the service provided after the product is distributed. So I don't think it's that the original notion was invalid, but that each of the terms was far too simple, and we're beginning to unbundle them, and that requires a redefinition of relationships among the terms.
Great, thank you. I'd like to, I think that gives us a great segue, which I'd like to take advantage of, to talk more about some of the economic issues, and maybe from the jumping off point of what has become a more and more kind of communal collaborative enterprise and what that does to the economics of the creation and the dissemination of these artworks. And maybe I could turn back to you and ask you to describe some of the things that your company does and the kinds of thinking that you're applying.
Well, my company is not necessarily involved in a lot of that. Mm-hmm. We are involved in companies that in turn do this. But I'll try to describe an example. If a traditional artist was one that painted something and displayed it, and he was very much in control of what that artist would do, and the consumer just sort of consumed. Today we're starting to see a lot of projects, art projects, online where the artist is more or less like a catalyst in a sort of traffic cop in an organized chaos, where they set some direction and some boundaries of what the piece should be, and that is then populated by a very large user base, often hundreds and thousands of people that collaborate on the piece. And it's very difficult then to identify who does that art piece belong to? And in many ways, for the collaborators, the process of collaboration and selecting, editing, changing is just as important as the final piece. And it's not an ongoing performance piece. That is very difficult then to figure out where to draw the boundaries around that, because some of them are actually now starting to become quite successful, especially in the music space, where a DJ would put up some suggested beats and bass lines and so on, and then the community would put in samples that, that would kind of work well with the piece. And then that artist would go and play it in a club somewhere, and people would like it, and if they like it, they would record it in a studio and make a record out of it. And there, I know several musicians that have done that are well-known recording artists, and 75% of the material came from their fan base. And that's an interesting, and we haven't seen that as a reaction yet. But it would be interesting to ask Jonathan if your work as an editor of your bulletin board system, if suddenly someone created a book out of that and sort of captured, because you probably signed off your life on some sort of disclaimer at some point.
I never read those things.
And you know, if you use that analogy, how would you feel about that?
Yeah. And I first say, okay, you ask the question, who does this belong to? I say, belong to? What a strange question to ask. How does it become used to, like, creating this wonderful thing? It's like, all right, now who does it belong to? You know, who left this behind? And what does belong mean when you unpack it? It means at least two things. One thing it means is a right to say no. If it belongs to me, I can say, I don't want my thing there. You can't put out a book that's a compilation of things from my bulletin board because I own it. It belongs to me, I say no. So that's a whole series of ways that things can belong to you, which translate to restrictions on speech from other people.
But if someone has signed a piece of paper that say, anything I write here doesn't belong to me.
Right. Well, what you would do, I mean, if you really wanted to walk through the legal doctrine on it, you would say,
thinking of you as a person, how do you feel about that?
I feel, and this is a feeling influenced by the fact that the bulletin board I steward, for which people post messages, and I am kind of the benevolent, smiling person above it all, is not my primary means of income. So it's not taking bread off my table in a readily discernible way to me to say, you know what, for the first aspect of belong, the ability to say no, I don't say no. If somebody wants to take these messages and put them elsewhere and put up a compendium, I only ask that you send me a copy so that I can enjoy it myself. But even so, it's yours. Of course, the other way in which something can belong to you in this sense is the ability to make money from it. Particularly not just I can use it and people can pay me for it, but if others use it, I get the ability to claim a piece of their action. I am a 33% owner of that, so I want 33% of all your income. And again, because I'm not really on the spot, I say, God bless you, make as much money as you want. Don't come around to me and say, I can't at some later date create my own CD. I wouldn't say that your use of it is exclusive. So in that sense, it belongs to me. And in fact, maybe it belongs to me for the purpose of saying, I assert my ownership so that nobody else may proprietize it. To say, I assert my ownership so that nobody else can take it, create something, and then claim exclusive right to it. And that's actually, it's a kind of a derivative called copyleft, where you take copyright and you say, yes, I am asserting my copyright. I'm not putting it in the public domain, but I'm asserting it only for the purpose of making sure that any derivative work you make, any use you get out of it, is poisoned by my copyright to prevent you from claiming sole and exclusive belonging of it to you. So again, I have the easy question. Now, if that were my only source of income, it would then depend on whether I bought into Sasha and maybe your view of the new economy that would say, just trust the force, give it away, and it'll still come back to you in notoriety, in, you know, I'll be asked to shepherd more bulletin boards, not just the one I'm doing, since people will see how well I'm doing it as word gets out. But again, that's a leap of faith that I'd have to make to say, geez, I really wish I could just get $5 a pop on every CD that comes out containing my work.
Well, that raises the question of what it is if you are actually selling it. And I'm going to problematize another term here, which is what is capital? Money is only one form that capital takes. Capital really is the ability to make something happen in future. That could be money. Money isn't everything as we know. It can be positioning relative to trends in a society. Sasha has certainly a future. I don't know what kind of pile of money he sits on right now. And what we're finding in today's economy is exactly that, that in a network economy, we're beginning to learn that cooperation and coordination are as important as competition for long-term economic survival, even in money terms. We're finding that innovation itself arises much more rapidly and richly in a networked environment, that those in the, if we're talking about corporate technological innovation, that you are more successful if you are sharing your intellectual property rights through networked relationships than holding them to themselves. There's a whole intellectual capital movement spawned by corporations that realized if they owned a pile of assets like a shopping center, they were losing money, whereas if they invested in something that looked like there were no assets involved, a software company, they were making money, and realized that this notion of capital as a physical object or as a pile of cash wasn't really getting at capital in terms of the long-term enabling of what you're going to do. This seems to me an opportunity, actually, if you don't mind, to move a little bit outside of the intellectual property rights domain and say if then what we're looking at is enabling processes that as a society we want to participate in the long term, the role of the artist as producer of product is only one of the roles. Among the other roles that artists play is the value in the innovations as modeling other ways of living together socially, other kinds of cultural forms. We're certainly at a moment of great turbulence and chaos in our social systems when actually what artists have to offer in terms of modeling those new kinds of relationships may be particularly valuable. There's been an argument in terms of one of the big policy debates when you just talk about the network per se is the question of universal access. How big a responsibility do we have to ensure that everyone actually has an opportunity to access to be a producer and to access information and the services of the net, and how widely defined should be the range of services to which we want to ensure everyone has access, that is not just your voice telephone call, but are we ensuring that everyone has access to the information and the kinds of services that are available. And it seems to me that actually among the most important policy issues for artists is universal access as opposed to the intellectual property rights issue, not as opposed to and not replacing, but in addition to. And another issue is the archiving and the educational response to what artists produce. If we're looking at artists not just as producing the thing you stick on the wall, but as those who are modeling, finding, demonstrating, inventing new ways of operating in a turbulent environment, then we have a responsibility to make sure that what artists produce is being distributed, accessible to those in different places, and so on. So I think there are other issues besides, in some ways, what's the short horizon issue of who gets the cash in the immediate transaction.
I wanted to speak to a couple of things that you've just brought up now that also touch on things that you mentioned before. You said, you know, we have no Rupert Murdoch now for new media, but we do have Bill Gates, which, you know, you also spoke to that as well. In other words, right now, as far as the tools for creating, you know, all of this art, it is right now in the hands of the companies that are creating the software to, you know, to decide who is going to have access to that creative process. And I think that, you know, that is something that I am scared of, although I am connected to people who I think, you know, in the event of that, I will be able to get my hands on a cracked copy or whatever. A lot of people aren't, and I don't think it's right that, you know, because of my connections, I'll be able to then make art with these tools, and most people won't. Also, I wanted to backtrack a little, and as far as us throwing our music out there, it's not out of, I mean, partly it's out of some desire to just get it out there, but it's also, I mean, there are real concrete things that come back out of that. And you were speaking a moment ago about, you know, actual, you know, money is not the only kind of capital. Well, one example of that is since putting this music up on our site, we've had offers flooding in from around the East Coast and the West Coast as well for gigs. People want us to come play because they like the music. And if we, you know, they're ready to, you know, fly us over or, you know, and we'll be paid for those gigs. So I certainly, I'm not an independently wealthy person, and I'm hoping to make some kind of money through my art, although we can get into that later. Yes, and the other thing I wanted to talk about was this idea of access to tools. I think one thing that you'll see happen over and over again, and historically, and I think it maybe is exploding now, or I mean, what is done with new technologies that come out, the potential of those technologies is often done out of economic necessity. So when we're talking about dance music, for example, the entire dance music industry and, you know, hip-hop, house music, jungle, all of these, you know, forms of music, using two turntables was an innovation that came about. You know, partly there was no company that said, "Oh, let's make a mixer with a crossfader, and you can use two turntables, and you can mix one record with another record and create a new, you know, piece of music that way." This was done the stories vary, but in the South Bronx by Cool Herc or Grandmaster Flash, depending on who you talk to. These were, you know, innovators who took their equipment, opened it up, rewired it, played with it, and those innovations have now spawned a global industry, which they're not getting props for. They're not getting paid every time someone sells a mixer or makes a mix, if you want to talk about the process of it. Every time someone mixes two records together, they're not getting paid. Now, I don't think they would want to get paid every time someone mixes two records together, but, you know, I don't know, I just think it's important to talk about the artistic use of all these technologies that are being developed often do come out of, you know, they don't necessarily come out of a comfortable situation where an artist is given a developed product by Bill Gates and he says, you know, create some art with this. It's people, you know, going into things and hacking them and playing with them. And I don't think that has to be an oppositional relationship to what's coming out of, you know, industry. I think that that's, you know, that's sort of a natural part of the way that artistic innovation works. It's people take this thing that's developed for one purpose and use it for an entirely different purpose.
Yeah, so innovation that just sort of escapes into the environment and becomes more broadly influential.
Well, but then those innovations are often then taken and packaged and sold by somebody else.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting opportunity here from a policy point of view and provide access both to create and to consume is one where it doesn't take a lot of... It is almost publicly accessible today through many means to be able to create things that then are seen by a lot of people. To use an example, a site like GeoCities, where you can create your own website, is free, and there is a natural hierarchy system based on sort of merits and what the user editors like. So people without little means can go through the public library and create their web space that have some interesting content, that, and some of them have absolutely mind-blowing amounts of traffic. Sites dedicated to social issues, to literary figures, to Star Wars heroes, and so on, that are created by amateurs, and very often in not necessarily comfortable situations socioeconomically, have created great spaces. The problem is that all of that value was what Yahoo paid billions of dollars to buy. It was the fact that the aggregation of all of that amateur work that was seen by the amateurs as being wonderful, as a tool to have access to build and access to an audience to show too. And it's through this hierarchical system of editors and promoters of their amateur work. But in many ways, they're true professionals because that's the essence of the value of the company that was then was worth billions of dollars. And that starts to become really complex because it is when an aggregation of amateur work becomes worth billions of dollars because it is an infrastructure for amateurs. Then we're into some kind of weird territory that I'm not sure how I'm curious what you know other people think of that.
Let's add one more twist. Now it's not an individual or a group of individuals doing the creation, but intelligent agents out there collaboratively producing work. Who's the owner? Who's the creator there?
Can you say more about what you mean by intelligent agents?
If you've launched an intelligent agent with capacities to act basically independently and interact with other intelligent agents in the web environment, we're already reaching legal issues about what are the contractual obligations of commitments that your agents may make on your behalf, perhaps without having discussed it with you beforehand. And the same, you know, it seems to me, I don't know that they've arisen yet, but that shortly it will happen, that there are individual agent creative efforts and collaborative agent efforts that result in artworks, if we want to focus on our topic of the day, and where the ownership rights reside. Are we going to say that the ownership rights should reside in the agents themselves and not in those who launch them?
Well, yeah, saying that the digital butler did it, so he would force away your contract is another problem. I guess my overall reaction to this is to say, you know, you describe this wonderful GeoCities, this kind of burbling of, you know, amateur sites where people just say whatever they like, and collectively it's worth billions of dollars. And my reaction, I guess it's not Star Wars, it's Star Trek, is to say, you know, for how long? For how long? Because I see a possibility that that aspect of the internet, and I'd be curious how many people here have either gone to a site that's a GeoCities or other site, you know, amateur run or created one yourselves. But I'm actually thinking it may well be like CB radio. It's a kind of interesting thing while it happens. Several smoky movies are made extolling its virtues and creating a culture around it, and then it's on to the next toy. And we're in a really possibly transient time now where Lucasfilm hasn't yet figured out how to put its creative energy really powerfully into the internet. The vaunted convergence between the internet and television and movie has not happened. When they meet, and I think it is just a question of when rather than if, is the result going to look more like the internet or like television? And that in large part will be driven by demand, what people who are the kind of people who might look at art or look at entertainment or read the news, what do they want? I mean, the real value when it comes down to billions of dollars for GeoCities is the value of eyeballs that stare at GeoCities pages and then can read ads, little banners put at the top, this page brought to you by GeoCities. And should that interest wane because there are suddenly other things to see on the web, so too with the value of those pages. And the real question then is, when people go online, when people click and point at something, they're not sitting at the television, they're sitting at their computer, what are they expecting to do there? Why is it that what they want to see maybe is social commentary that they would never have sat through on cable access? And when they're on television mode, what they're wanting to see is the 10 o'clock news or Star Trek. And what consumer demand will amount to there in a space where, as you just pointed out, everything is in flux is a good question. And I worry that there are forces at work, including the construction of the code and the tools by which to build in the space are becoming increasingly difficult to access by amateurs, and by law as well, that these will together make it so that the space becomes a lot more television-like. And it'll be like the early days of television where, wow, this great educational medium, you know, every channel will be PBS, and suddenly, I mean, it just seems like such a quaint thought now. And I wonder if we're not reliving history in a way, and if we are, what there might be to put a stone in the stream and turn it in another direction.
Let's hope you're wrong.
And in fact, as somebody who's been studying the development of the medium, I think that the answers to some of that are already out there. We know that in homes where people have the net, that TV watching is plummeting. And that I think that even though there will be push technologies that are successful, it won't replace the other. Just to mention it also, we're beginning to find that up to 15% of web surfers experienced internet users after 3 years of experience, meaning 3 years of use or more, not tried it and got frustrated, are abandoning the net. So it's not necessarily a simple linear future that we should be looking at.
Hmm. Yeah. Do we know why they're abandoning the net? Is there any market research on this?
Lots of anecdotes, but but no.
I mean, in the early days of the net, there was a time when the kinds of bulletin boards that I run, I don't know how many people know what a sysop is in here. I wouldn't expect a lot of people to know that. These were bulletin boards where people would get on. It was a completely text-based environment. There was just not the bandwidth for graphics. So people would type at each other, and not just like a chat room kind of type. They would post messages, and the messages would stay in the area so that others who visited later could read them and then reply to them, and you'd get this kind of collaborative messaging. And people would talk about art and politics and computers and Bill Gates and everything else. I already see that fading. I see it becoming more.
No, I disagree with that. It's just becoming more more granularized and more specific in vertical interest areas. I belong to a community that's devoted to ancient history, and we have bulletin boards and chat rooms in Old Greek and Latin.
It is so hardcore, and people live there. But it's become it's much more sophisticated than the old style communities, because it's much more alive, and it's worldwide sub communities. There's even, I mean, I belong to then a subgroup that is Britannica, or Britannia, which is the Roman history in Britain. And then you can even divide that into even smaller subgroups of people that are interested in the Bath area of Roman history in Britain.
I think I met you in that group.
Yeah. and to me, that's the beauty of this medium, is that you will then find, if you can then aggregate a large enough user base of people devoted to Roman history, you can actually justify commission passive entertainment, televised entertainment, that addresses that audience, and you can justify that economically. And that becomes really interesting.
Well, let me ask a question in relation to that, because to use your expression, is that the audience is that granular in its construction. Is it possible then to mobilize enough aggregate consumer demand to keep the internet from going the way of commercial television? Or is it too anarchic a community in order to be able to mobilize it to the degree that will probably be necessary to change to make sure those policies are in place?
That's a very good question. I think from a policy point of view, it's difficult to see how that's going to map out. But what we do see is that policies don't really catch up with the consumers. The consumers are way ahead of anything that anyone can sort of structuralize legally or from the sort of political arena. And they're going to find their own ways, and they do. The latest thing I saw was this beautiful community on pets, and it was on horses, and it's not race horses, it's riding horses, and it was 15 different subgroups of different, and there were thousands of people that were devoted to Arabian half-breed sort of people that had these horses in sort of, you know, and then geographically. And that's going to be the future, in my opinion.
I would just point to some of the features of the technologies. It's people who are very utopian about it talk about the non-hierarchical nature of the net. It is that the nature of the technological structure makes it possible to be non-hierarchical. Doesn't mean that it necessarily will be, but I do think there are things that make how we deal with that technology so very different from any technology other than the book. That we have had historically, that I guess I'm less afraid of the single channel kind of push. If I may, I'd just like to throw one more complication on the table. We haven't talked about what the experience of art is over the web. We've left the user out of it, other than as one who contributes to creation of the product. And I just wanted to mention that we are beginning to understand ways in which we actually think, process information, experience information differently when we get it from the web environment, then from how we got it in broadcast, and then from how we got it in print. When you are surfing the web, we show brainwave patterns that are like REM dream sleep. There is no other media use that shows that kind of brainwave pattern. And so we shouldn't assume that because when we are experiencing art in the web environment, that it's the same other than the delivery medium from experiencing it in a museum or in a concert hall.
I just want to add, and I know, Marion, you want to open it up to the audience, too, but I really want Thomas to be right. I mean, we're on the same side as far as how I think we'd like it to come out. And it does get to the question of, you know, what's the magic number of channels on your cable box after which the new channel is different than the others? I mean, you know, now that we've got I've got 99 channels in Cambridge, including pay-per-view. The new channels are going to pay-per-view. They're not going to Arabian horse channels. I mean, yeah, there's a Discovery Channel, and there's a Literature Channel.
The future is going to be Jonathan Channel. where you get
but
your
stuff. But it's going to be pay-per-view. Is Jonathan going to be pay-per-view?
I'll
tell you the rest of it, I think. Of course, aside from waiting and seeing, and of course we're both in large part arguing from anecdote, you do want to say, well, all right, is there any way we could get some data on this? We're actually doing a project called Norms in Cyberspace. By which there's these things called Usenet. Usenet is the collection of so-called news groups. News groups, in turn, are these bulletin boards, the sort of thing that I run for CompuServe in the proprietary CompuServe environment. And we're actually taking, there's this company called Deja News.
Deja News, little did people know it when they were posting news groups in the late 80s, but all of it was being recorded, and it's all getting into Deja News, so you can type in my name, or you can type in Arabian half-breeds, or whatever you like, and Deja News will spit back every single message ever that has ever mentioned that since 1970.
Think about that when you're applying for jobs.
Yeah. So in the meantime, we're actually we're building an engine to actually look at these groups and see there is a Usenet group for Arabian horses, and actually map it over time and see is the vitality of the group measured along these particular dimensions and demographics, number of participants, international flavor. I mean, you can come up with demographics. How has it evolved over time? And we're actually, in the spirit of openness, putting the very engine onto the net for free so that you can come up and make your own queries and get your own demographics out of it. So it'd be interesting to see if there are measurable trends coming out that say whether these things are more or less popular.
That's a sign of a realm that's beginning to gel into a identifiable realm if the data is beginning to be collected about it.
Yeah.
I'd like to, we only have about 20-25 minutes left, so I would like to turn over to the audience for questions, and I saw one hand shooting right up back there. We have mics that can travel. Is this on?
Yes.
Okay, hi. It strikes me that the conversation so far, with maybe some exception by Sandra, has been pretty narrowly focused on a particular time period in history, a particular set of policies and parameters that shape our society, and that the assumption we're making is that these questions are all newer than I think maybe they are. If you go back into time, there have always been, I'm sure, issues of each culture has to define for itself where it falls on that scale between community and individuality in terms of its art as well as in terms of other things. Our society has picked the place much more towards the end of individuality. If you look back into history and even if you look around the world, probably the majority of people and the majority of time have lived in communities where the assumption was that art would be shared, where the community was small enough that if you created something, everybody in the community knew that you did, and that somebody else in that community appropriated it, socially that was taken care of. I'm not sure that there's a question here, I just wanted to point that out. And I think that the policies that we adhere to, or that we all let our society operate under, we let that create a situation where the rewards are so important, and then leads me to a whole other question, which is perspective. When I was Sasha's age, I had that same perspective that my art, in my case it was sort of use of media and reporting of news events, should be shared and should be available to everybody, and what did I need to have personal gain from that. It was more important to me that the society had use of what I had to offer. Then I spawned Sasha, and it wasn't until I needed to put him through Harvard that I looked back and said, what have I done? Now I can't afford to do that, and all those years I was letting my work just sort of be distributed. So I think it becomes a matter of perspective in our society, and the reason it does then is because we don't support our artists, and those are policy decisions that are being made and parameters that we agree to live under. I think that in some ways we're coming back around with Thomas's smaller and smaller divisions of who you can talk to on the net. If you in your Roman history group in England, whatever it was, start claiming somebody else's ideas as your own, you're now part of a small enough community that they're going to know it, So it's going to be interesting to see how this works as we go into time, but I don't think they're new questions.
Thank you for reminding us. Thanks for making Sasha for us.
Yeah. I'm Rob.
Thank you for reminding us that cyber artists are only a subset of artists, and that the issues of how we support creativity and support artists in our communities are really deeply important. I'd like to ask Thomas to respond a little bit from the point of view of how this work is supported in Europe, and then we can open it up to the rest of the panel.
Well, one of the things that you brought up, which is really interesting, is this is not a new thing. And that's very true, but it's very visible, and it's sort of naked, and it's such a scale, and the barriers to entry for someone to produce something that other people can consume is almost nil. So therefore, it becomes just such a much more sort of immediate as a concern, and that also means that, for instance, I'm sure in your work, Miriam, when you sit and evaluate funding proposals, it is difficult to evaluate how unique is this? How difficult is it for someone to do this?
Or is uniqueness even a value that you insist
on? Exactly. You know, and those are issues that are very difficult to figure out, because all this has happened so very, very quickly. And in Europe now, the EU has put together a massive research project. I can't remember the actual acronyms now. That's one of the beauties of EU, that they are very good at sort of seven-letter acronyms. But it's a 2.3 billion euro, which is sort of equivalent to US dollars, research project to define what media is in a sort of interactive sense. And there's a large chunk of that which is devoted to creation of artwork. And this past Monday, I was at the first workshop where they had about 15 different artists around Europe. They were all brought together in this place outside of London, where they sort of create the first kind of set of some policy issues and some sort of parameters for how artists will work and can work, and how funding groups around Europe were going to then look upon these projects. And I think that was it's a great initiative. Unfortunately, there's lots of sort of bureaucratic aspects of it, which is less fortunate, but we sort of have to. I think we prefer to live with that rather than not have it. But it's going to be interesting to see what's going to come out of that. But there's at least some hope on that.
Thanks. Comments from other panelists on that subject.
I'll go back to the universal access argument. Some of the most successful projects using the internet that we've seen in the U.S. have been those generated by artists in ethnic and religious and cultural and racial minority communities who are committed to their art, but take these technologies into the communities and offer them to kids who are otherwise wandering the streets, and develop out of the communities themselves, not because there was aid, not because there was national level policy, but because the kids are gaining sellable skills, generating sources of income within those communities themselves. So it's I think that the habit of artists to look towards direct funding from a federal level or a state level government is to some degree archaic and romantic, and that diffusion of access is going to generate its own economic value that will probably support a lot more people than direct funding. I say that having never received direct funding as an artist, of course, but
nice when you can get it, but,
yeah.
You know.
Go ahead.
I think for me, one thing that we need to think about is last summer to gather footage for this project, which you saw a little piece of today, I spent some time in London gathering footage of Carnival there. And while I was there, I had the opportunity to meet so many young artists, people who were my age, I'm 23, many of whom were supporting themselves not necessarily through their art, but because of the strong social network that is in place there. You know, their rent was subsidized by the dole, and their health care is partially covered by the government there, and that allows them then to go and make art and be artists, not because they're getting direct grants from the government to produce their art, but because there's a strong social safety net there, which doesn't exist here. And I think that, ultimately, you know, this conversation would need to head there if we want to talk about, well, how is it, how are we going to support the arts? It's how are we going to support people in this country in general, artists being a subset of them. And so I'd like to throw that out there.
Thanks very much. Other questions? I see you, and then I'll take these two over here. Go ahead, sir.
One of the one of the fundamental characteristics of capitalist society is the production of property or goods and services that are exchanged for other goods and services or money, and the control of that production of that property. And I'm wondering, given the diffusion of intellectual property on the internet, specifically speaking about intellectual property related to art, and given the access, hopefully universal access, that everybody will have to it, and also the ability of everybody to have access to the tools to create their own art from this other raw material, are we talking about a new economic system? Is this kind of art compatible with our current conception of capitalist economics? Or in order for this art to flourish, do we need to come up with a new concept of economy and new capitalism?
It's not necessarily a new idea argument. That it's not incompatible with capitalism. In fact, it may well be supportive of capitalism to eliminate monopoly. I mean, monopoly, the antitrust law, is an important part of the government's function to enable a capitalist economy, one in which you have competition that takes place on some kind of playing field so that the best products and services and art can emerge in some competitive, merit-based environment. So to the extent that monopoly stands in the way of that, intellectual property monopoly is yet another one of that. And it's not clear that capitalism calls for heavy propertization of the fruits of your intellectual labor. I mean, Jefferson was completely opposed to this and just lost, but settled for, all right, for a limited time. It says in the Constitution, for a limited time. So I don't know that it necessarily entails a new system to be able to think about it, although to the extent that more and more of what we're doing is happening as ideas and happening in a networked environment, the fact that ideas have a much different shape to them, a much different behaviors than bricks or mortar may well be relevant. I mean, I also think of the fact that with everything equally a click away from anywhere in the world, to be able to develop art with local context can become a lot harder. I mean, suddenly everybody's having Mickey Mouse readily available to them as part of their artistic project. On the one hand, it's good. On the other hand, it may seem actually a homogeneity caused by the equal availability of cultural context, you know, just this one kind of generic context that everybody's performing in. Of course, that's a different view than Thomas's sort of narrow casting. People form other communities that are subsets, and then that's the context out of which they create their art.
In response to the local, we're also now beginning to see people from, I'm going to forget where the case was from, but from very traditional cultures who are seeing their traditional melodies showing up on Nike ads and actually pursuing Nike. So I think, as in many other ways, we're also seeing a resurgence of the local. I would change the question that you asked and say it's not that in order to deal with art we need to rethink the economy, but that what's happening in art is one more manifestation of what's happening throughout the economy in terms of the resource distribution mechanisms qualitatively changing in this environment. And I would just point out that as antitrust law is also getting weaker and weaker in a lot of ways, most of the issues that are generating the exceptions to antitrust law that are part of that process of weakening it have to do with the communication and information industries, whether it's very large-scale chips or whatever. The kinds of consumer user involvement in the creation of product that we see in art, we're also seeing with large-scale computer platforms, with car design, with everything else. So in that sense, it's just one more quote-unquote industry responding to the same kinds of very macro-level changes in the nature of the economy.
Yes. Is this on? Okay. Could I just introduce Marion and the panel? This is George Fifield, who's the founder of the Boston Cyber Arts Festival.
Yay. Thank you.
This is a wonderful panel in that if you haven't answered all of my questions about cyber artists and cyber art, you've certainly asked all of them. But the one part, so the one question I'm bringing up that I feel you've missed, even though people have been talking about cyber artists and their art and corporate or commercial ownership, there's most art, from my point of view as a curator, actually is really presented to the public through nonprofit venues like museums, organizations which deal in a certain level of connoisseurship that is not entirely commercial. And I wanted to, I was actually horrified a while back to attend a panel discussion similar to this with a whole series of new, all younger than I am, curators in town at various institutions, and the entire hour and a half was spent discussing the collection and exhibition of objects. And yet, you have other instances where one of the most important works of collaborative artworks, David Douglas's The World's Longest Sentence, is now owned by a museum. The purpose of owning that, in a way, is really to relieve Douglas of having to support this important artwork. So my question to you all is, what is the role, the public role, in this new art economy and this new art structure of the non-commercial, non-profit arts organizations? And to be perfectly blunt, what is the role of the Boston Cyber Arts Festival?
Well,
please.
Well, I think there's the distinction between what's the role of existing arts organizations and new constellations, because there are arts organizations out there that are not, that doesn't belong in a building, it doesn't have necessarily a name, or belong just to on a server somewhere. It might be on a commercial server, but where the artist got some space from someone they knew, or on lots of university stuff, where I'm sure Sasha has all his work on a Harvard server somewhere, or do you have it on a, have you rented space somewhere?
Harvard already kicked me off the server since I graduated a few months ago.
well, that's the one. We actually managed to answer one then, that they shouldn't kick off their artist students that quickly. But the question is, which is very difficult question to ask, is where, what's the role of existing arts organizations? Because as you seem to attest to, that they haven't managed to make that transition very well. And to me, it sounds to me that they're a new constellation, and maybe your festival should be something that's ongoing from an infrastructure point of view, because that's not necessarily the costly part. The costly part is to create the physical representation of it, and the marketing and so on to make people aware of it. But if you created a space that was accessible year-round through the internet, and that you could archive the material and post new stuff, that in my opinion would be a kind of a new institution that was created with the current kind of thinking in mind. That to me is interesting, and I think that there should be some policies put in place to provide or to at least allow for that kind of funding. So you don't have to have a 200-year-old or 100-year-old sort of foundation in your back to get to that kind of position.
I don't know if I can answer the question of what the role is of traditional or existing cultural organizations, but I can maybe speak to some barriers to those cultural organizations examining that question and coming to an answer. And would refer specifically to an article by Robert Atkins in last month's Art in America about the state of online art, in which he talks, among other things, I referenced this earlier in my introductory remarks, about the lack of any kind of art historical or aesthetic discourse about this work, and the lack of any, which either within a kind of a scholarly community or at the journalistic level, which would allow, for instance, museums or visual arts organizations to think in those terms
to understand what the role of this body, what the relationship of this body of work is with the rest of what their mission and operations are about. So I think it may be partly that it's such a new area of endeavor that until there is a sort of a body of discourse about it that has developed, it's going to be difficult for existing nonprofit cultural organizations to find their way.
That's kind of tempting because then one wants to nominate certain individuals whose research should be supported in order to generate that. I think there is some stuff out there. Gregory Ulmer and Johanna Drucker, for example, are writing very usefully about this stuff. I would hope my own work contributes to it. But my guess is that where we will see nonprofits going is that, again, as with other kinds of corporations, other kinds of organizations, that the boundary lines may begin to shift a bit. And just as artists are more comfortable now being hired by corporations, there may be more allegiances between nonprofits and the corporate world. And in fact, we certainly, in the last half dozen years, we've seen a lot of nonprofits actually spinning off for-profit elements of their operations in order to support the nonprofit. So I think we'll see some more experimentation of that.
Hybrid
kind
and different forms of structures for support. Yeah, I think it's a good point. There was a question behind you, and then I'll get to Joan.
There's one type of artist that doesn't necessarily seem to have a place, or the place is ill-defined, and those are artists who need audiences. Concerts, dance, and theater. What do each or any of you see as a way of getting the cyber aspect of the arts world in touch with the parts of the arts world that are dependent upon audiences?
Well, one thing that suggests actually relates to the previous question is that one function of established institutions to which people turn for their arts, for, you know, they trust them to say, it's worth walking into this exhibit because our curators have put together a great show for you. They have a gatekeeper function then. They actually say, here's some great stuff. And they can be in a position to say, here's some great cyber stuff. And you didn't even know you liked cyber stuff until you came through our gate. So that's one way in which it might relate. And you also imagine that, and I guess it is what connoisseurship is. It's discerning quality from lack of quality and asserting that there exists something called quality that inheres in some objects and not in others. And that means, particularly if part of our premise has been an explosion of stuff, of content, that people are saying, this is art, this is art, this is art, wondering, starting to ask, all right, well then how do people wade through it and look at that which is of quality? And that opens up, of course, questions that are enduring. It's not like they're new questions, but certainly brings to bear the purpose or the function of existing nonprofit collective organizations that showcase, display, and basically are the buffer between the public at large and artists to bring them together to see them doing it with cyber art and doing it with some cyber art and not other cyber art, for better or worse.
There are some performing artists already who are looking to various cyber tools to pursue their investigations of their work, but they're used more as tools rather than as creating artworks in a cyber environment. But it might be interesting for cultural organizations to commission some of those artists to make work in these new forms as a way of crossing those boundaries. Joan?
I wanted to also...
Oh, I'm sorry. Go, oh, yes, you're the one who should be answering this question.
I don't think that we should conflate cyber art with internet art. There are a lot of artists who don't do anything at all with the internet, who are using computers as the tool or one of the tools in their palette to create. And there's some wonderful things being done by dancers, for example, with various kinds of body sensors that can control sound. Teresa Marin at the MIT Media Lab is working with that, as is Merce Cunningham.
Mm-hmm. Bill T. Jones.
Bill T. Jones. So I think I just wanted to make sure that, you know, we talked about that. But also, actually, that brings me to something else, which is I get very... I think that the thing to do is not to, when talking about computers and artists, it's not to start narrowing our vision and looking at all of this new art and defining a separate category of art that is purely cyber, or that is, you know, we're only going to look now at art that is made, you know, by people with computers. I think that, like every other tool that artists have always used, you know, computers are another tool that artists can use, and most people who are working with them are working are using them to combine other media that they're already working with, or as one in a range of tools, or as part of their process. And I get a little scared because there's always so much hype about every new technological tool that comes out, when really, it's just people making art with
whatever
the resources they have, what's at hand.
Yeah, thank you very much. So can we squeeze in one more question? Yes, go ahead. This will be the last
question. Oh, well, I actually had two, but maybe I'll try to pick one, squeeze them together. But my questions have to do with about the sociology of cyberspace. And they are two, and probably not, I'd just like to hear your points of view on them. One is that the deepest knowledge about the sociology of cyberspace is often not available to the public discourse because it is proprietary information, whether it's generated by Intel or AT&T. And so my question, and you cannot, this is the public policy forum, you cannot make public policy absent information and data, the best data not available to policymakers. So here's a question about the academy. Is there any way that the academy could find a way to re-aggregate this information source in a way that it could then be helpful to public policy? Then my subset of that question is, within that context of the sociology of cyberspace, what is known about the role of the artist and the perception of the value added of the artist in that environment, in terms especially of creativity and innovation? Who's looking at that? What do we know about why we care about artists in cyberspace and what they're doing?
Thank you. Great question. Who's going to tackle it? As somebody who spends most of my time thinking about policy, mostly that question must simply be taken as a challenge, and certainly I'll agree with you, academia, most academics are really way behind what's going on, and that makes then the policymakers even further behind. My argument has been to try to expand the concept of policy from to widen it beyond public sector decision-making to decision-making that plays a structural role in society. And that means that as we think about policy, it means working with corporations as well as with governments. What that means in terms of transforming the sense of responsibility on the part of corporations to the societies in which they operate is still a question, but we are beginning to see some tools, ways in which corporate responsibility, ways in which corporations must be responsible to the societies in which they operate. In fact, the argument often goes that the only reason we still have nation states is that they make it possible for corporations to operate by setting up labor laws and things like that. But I think paths like requiring corporations to give back, which again we're seeing mostly in the area of biotechnology, but I think it's providing a model, requiring two-way exchanges with the societies to which they're taking resources, which requires articulating those resources as resources and not simply something that can be taken. And so there's a conceptual task there that will be required before a persuasive task in the development of the specific legal instruments that can be used. In answer the second part of that, your question, basically, I think at the moment artists are largely being had. Xerox PARC loves to run artists through there. It's a wonderful experience for the artists who get their hands on, but I think that the value that they're leaving behind is much greater than that they take away with themselves. And so there I think it's a question of raising the sophistication of artists themselves to negotiate different kinds of agreements with those organizations with which they become involved.
I think I can perhaps shed a little light on that, because we do both as an organization. We're very clear about the distinction of the artists we work with where there's a clear commercial intent. We also work with artists where we give them grants, where there's no commercial intent, but we feel that what they are doing when it comes to exploring sort of the frontiers of interactivity is so important for what we do, and just the association with them and the learning we get from them is worth it for us and our portfolio companies to work with them. And that they then have, they can then produce art that people can consume and experience and learn from, and be but it's, we have to have, we discovered that we couldn't They couldn't do both at the same time, because there has to be a boundary, because you can't really appropriate everything because it will be ruined in the process.
To me, the key is first having the public conception of the space be broader than it is now. People either see it as a commodity. It's like studying electricity. I guess someone has to do it, but it, you know, you don't see it as like a sociological phenomenon. Of course, when you think about it, electricity is a sociological phenomenon. 100 years later, we realize that and then turn back and study it. And second, the conception of it is as a shopping mall. It's .com. When we think of the internet today, we think of .com. And that's fine. I mean, the great point about it is it's a fairly infinitely extensible space, so you don't have to take anything away from .com to have something else. But it would be for me, I think, to say the university needs to realize that it needs, somebody has to stand up for .edu. What does it mean to put .edu into the World Wide Web space? Does it just mean a brochure for your school so people can click on it and get application materials? Does it mean a commodified distance learning where it's a cash cow to support your real operations that take place in a traditional way? And the answer so far are yes and yes by academia at large to that. So to me, it's realizing that studying the web, particularly because it's moving at the speed that it is not a spectator sport. You can't do it the way you normally do, which is to read what other people have written about it, think hard, and write new stuff about it that other people then read. I mean, 6-month publishing cycles mean that you're writing about the web of 1992 today, if that's what you're going to do, and there wasn't one then. So all that leads me to say the universities have to get engaged. They actually have to identify issues that are near and dear to them in the space and be upfront about engaging them and realize that it's a much more versatile and a space with far more potential than is captured by thinking of it as electricity or thinking of it as a shopping mall. And that could trickle down to artists as well. I mean, it's actually high time. There's a .arts domain. I guess right now it's going to be under .org or something. And perhaps the people that are now responsible newly for creating such domains could do it. In fact, .arte or something. Why make it English, right? Make it something else. So,
Sasha, can I give you the last word here?
I think Jonathan, what you just said is basically the same answer to George's earlier question, which is how can existing arts organizations become more involved in this? And, you know, it's the same situation. Rather than, you know, the museum website being, you know, a page about simply about the real museum, you know, that can be, you know, another wing of the museum, another, you know, whole level of its operations. And I also think that I just wanted to throw in, when you were talking about the importance to academia, I think we also need to be thinking about the fact that if we want people to be producing good art with these tools, we need to provide them with those tools, younger than once they get to university. And, you know, I'm not sure how that's going to come about. I'm a little bit wary about just allowing corporate entrance into schools and letting, you know, whoever wants to come donate their, you know, particular hardware package of the moment in our, you know, elementary schools, allowing that to happen. But at the same time, I think we need to engage with that more than we have.
Terrific. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Sasha for the work and all of the panel for the great discussion. And I'd also like to thank the Office of the Arts at Harvard and Radcliffe and the Radcliffe Public Policy Institute for convening this conversation. Thanks very much.
Great, guys. I love how your mom asked the question. Okay.
She came all the way from upstate New York.
Is that right?
Oh, great. Well, there's other stuff going on.
Sure.
Yeah, I know. I kept feeding him a line and he kept not giving it up. Uh-huh.